bullshitting is largely Machiavellian in nature. You have an agenda. But it's also important to know that people bullshit without knowing they're doing it because they're not supported, they're not coached, they're not trained, they're stressed out. People are just doing their best. And say, yeah, you know, I shouldn't have really answered that question with the confidence levels that I have. I should have said that I don't know, but I work in an environment where I will look inadequate if I say I don't know, and maybe even suffer because I say I don't know. So I just made stuff up.
In our current climate of digital paradigm shifts, over-the-wall synergy, and bleeding-edge disruption, it's vital for corporate innovators to have enough bandwidth to break down the silos, leverage headwinds, and circle back on peak actionable items. Look, I'm going to be honest, I have no idea what I just said, or if it made any sense. But in the world of corporate bullshit, I'm not sure that matters. Ian McCarthy is a professor of innovation and operations management at Simon Fraser University. His work seeks to understand why bullshit exists in organizational structures. In his 2020 paper, Confronting Indifference Towards the Truth, Dealing with Workplace Bullshit, he introduced the CRAP framework for helping organizations reduce bullshit. On today's episode, we talk BS in the workplace, the CRAP framework, and what, if anything, workers can do to survive corporate bullshit. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I am fascinated by bullshit research, and I like the fact that you've decided to focus in very much on bullshit within organizations and organizational structures. How did that come to be an area of interest to you?
From working in organizations and working with executives, obviously lead organizations, at one point I was curious, you know, why people would frequently lie in meetings or make things up around key decisions. And then someone said to me, you know, maybe they're not lying, maybe they're bullshitting, and there is a distinction. And as listeners will have known previous interviews, you know, Harry Frankfurt wrote this very interesting little book on distinguishing bullshit from lying. And then it made me think about, oh, so there is a distinction. And so in terms of how you should react to this form of misrepresentation, it's different from lying. Sometimes it's done knowingly, and sometimes it's done unknowingly, and sometimes the response that you should have, you know, should be adjusted. And so that's what led me down a whole sort of avenue of research, which was new to me a few years ago.
We should, for people who perhaps this is their first episode listening to the podcast, draw that distinction. So Harry Frankfurt said that a liar cares very much about the truth, whereas a bullshitter doesn't really care about the truth. The truth that whether something is true or not is sort of secondary. It might be true, it might be wrong. They simply don't care. Is that how you would define it?
You know, there's different types of bullshit which all conform under that definition. You know, but like an example was, I wanted to taint your reputation and say that you were a Manchester United fan, and I wanted to talk badly about you and say that you supported the soccer team Manchester United. Because, you know, I knew that these people who, you know, would look lowly on Manchester United fans, I would be bullshitting because I have no idea whether you are actually a Manchester United fan or not. I'm just using that for my agenda. But I could actually be correct. You could be a Manchester United fan. And then if I was to speak about somebody else, you know, who I knew, you know, supported, you know, a team or not, I actually knew that. And then I tried playing a similar communication game. I would be lying because I would have knowledge of the truth. And so, you know, Frankfurt says, you know, bullshitters may be more dangerous. That's an untested hypothesis of his. You know, some people have tried testing it, but they say bullshit is probably more dangerous because it's easier to do. You have the freedom to do it. And more people can do it than lying. Lying requires a sort of a careful circumvention of the truth.
I believe John Petrelli did some research showing that we tend to be less likely to call people on bullshit than on lies, that we tend to sort of accept if someone is bullshitting, we tend not to sort of call it out. in the same way as we might call someone out if they're saying something that is definitively untrue and we know they're being deceptive in that unique way. How does that then play out in an organizational setting? Are there specific types of bullshit or specific attributes of business bullshit or organizational bullshit that perhaps may not appear quite so commonly in other places?
Outside of the workplace, you know, in social settings, there's a lot of, social bullshitting where people tease each other and they joke and they want to get reaction. Dads and their children in terms of teasing, in terms of getting reactions and stuff. And so in many ways, that's often, not always, but often done in a harmless, jovial, social way. You know, I think at work, you know, there's less of that, but it does go on. But there's less of that, particularly in today's society. And when people are bullshitting, they're largely sort of doing two forms, which comes up in terms of trying to evade getting caught or trying to persuade somebody of an agenda. You know, a guy called Shane Littrell at the University of Waterloo, I think he was the guy who came up with these two types, you know, ways of framing it. Persuasive is you're wanting to sell, you want to convince, you're wanting to embellish, you know, you make stuff up to get your point across. Evasive bullshitting is, you know, you don't want to get caught out. You know, you don't want to get caught out that you did something wrong. You don't want to get caught out that you don't know. You know, don't have an answer. We don't like saying I don't know. You know, and in terms of that happens in the classroom, it happens in meetings, and so rather than saying I don't know, you know, we feel we have to make something up which is articulate and convincing, and you know, serves the purpose of maintaining our status. You know, it's also at work. You know, it can be a sort of social practice to fit in. And I think different companies have different cultures and different departments and different organizations have different cultures. But to some extent, you know, you play along, you know, and it's what you have to say and what you have to do to survive and thrive within that organization. And, you know, and the extent to which you can call out or call bullshit, you know, it depends on the culture of the organization, how much safety you have. You know, can you ask colleagues, can you ask superiors to prove something? And you know, can you be critical? Can you have an open critical mind towards, you know, their logic, their decisions, their statement? And it's not as common as we might think that we do have those environments, you know, that where we can say, excuse me, can you explain that a bit further? Because I don't understand it. I mean, we don't have that culture.
Does a part of that culture, when it comes to organizations and businesses, stem from the fact that they do tend to be largely hierarchical? And so because of those hierarchies, that there isn't the ability to question upwards? Even if you're told, yes, of course you can question us, of course you can ask difficult questions, it's still not in your best interest if you're at the bottom of the pyramid to be poking the people above you.
Absolutely. You know, organizations have hierarchies, but it's also the culture within those hierarchies, you know, the extent to which you can question. I mean, if you look at Japanese companies, they have a hierarchy, but they were famous in terms of manufacturing practices where people could stop the line and question and, you know, bring factories to a halt when they thought things were wrong in terms of doing things. Hospitals have been famous for not having that, you know, where questioned, where nurses and technicians yeah. question, you know, the surgeon, you know, are you working on the right body part, you know, in terms of doing things, and, you know, and they, you know, professionally chastised. Now, many regional healthcare practices, you know, authorities do have a stop the line policy to create that culture.
Yeah, during COVID, I ran some online workshops where we talked about all the different types of bullshit. And one of the attendees was a nurse who was talking, and this was, of course, she'd taken time out of dealing with COVID to attend this workshop, but she was talking about how literally every one or two days they were presented with a new set of rules that were being instituted by the hospital as new information came in. But because the rapidly changing situation, a lot of what was being said was bullshit. It was that it might be true, it might not be true, but they simply couldn't tell. And often the nurses were being given these instructions and they could tell immediately, this is not correct, this is not what we should be doing. But she had said she just had no ability to question it because it wasn't coming from the people directly above her. It was coming from people, you know, in administrative positions who were in a position of saying, we have to do something, we have to say something, so let's just say this.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's central to this culture of safety. Can you speak up? You know, can you be a professional dissenter in terms, because you think it's right for the organization? Yes, we can in many organizational settings, but there are many, many others where we can't, and it's because of the hierarchies, the way we measure and reward people, and just organizational life.
Are there other industries where you've seen these types of hierarchies appear commonly?
Almost all. I work in a university, and universities have a lot of university professors and academics have a lot of protection and a lot of authority, and that's probably one of the exceptions, I would say. But most other environments, there is a chain of command, and you can't question that chain of command, or it's difficult to question that chain of command. I also think that the flip side is it's when you look at I'm somebody who, like yourself, is interested in sort of champions a world with less bullshit. But it's also important to know that, like, it's hard to get rid of bullshit completely, because you never have complete certainty. You never have complete evidence. You never have real evidence, in terms of, it's always about adjusting your beliefs, in terms of, and I think that's more important, is to understand to what extent you have confidence levels in things that are being said and decisions that are being made. And as time passes by, you get more information, and you get up, Bayesian in terms of, you're always adjusting, your understanding and your knowledge with the latest set of information which comes through in terms of, and so that doesn't mean that what was said before was all bullshit, unless it was stated with real certainty and an arrogance in terms of going forward. But if you're sort of going through with sort of certain confidence levels, I think that's important. And that happens, happens in healthcare. There was still lots of research still happening on masks. Are masks good? Are masks bad? Lockdowns. We're learning more and more. The logic is strong. The evidence is following in terms of going forward. And sometimes the evidence goes one way or another way, but then it's interpreted and maybe given a spin in journalism. I mean, the worst industries, are marketing and politics and PR, social media platforms, in terms of just making things up because you have an agenda. That's where these worlds flourish, in terms of, because they don't care.
I have a list of what I call bullshit hotspots, five places that I think bullshit seems to flourish, and you just named four of them. And one of the things I've noticed about those four that you mentioned in particular is that in some organizations, say in a university, bullshit is obviously there's, sometimes it's necessary for social reasons, but for the most part, it's a bug. It's something that you would rather not have. The structure hopefully can work better without it. But in the case of politics and social media, say, just as an example, social media doesn't just allow bullshit, it thrives on bullshit. Without bullshit, you sort of, the social media kind of stops functioning, because if I say something which is a lie, people can very easily pick that apart and dismiss me on social media. If I say something that is true, people can accept it, or they can, try and deny it. But if I bullshit, I can get so much engagement. I can get so many people sharing and arguing and offering different perspectives.
Exactly. Persuasive bullshitting is about persuading somebody to believe you or to read an article or to put eyeballs on or click it. And so if you take a news story, and then you give it a headline which really probably isn't reflective or even accurately captures what actually happened, in terms of doing things, but it has this headline or it has this opening paragraph because, oh yeah, I like that, but the truth is a bit dull and the truth is not as interesting as it should be, or the truth is it doesn't suit my agenda. It's given a twist, and bullshitters have complete freedom to twist and misshape and mispresent, what they want to achieve their agenda, which in this case is to persuade you to click, to persuade you to like, to persuade you to reshare, to persuade you to vote for them, whatever it is, or to agree with the decision. And so you have that sort of freedom whereas dealing with the truth or even lying, requires anchoring in the truth, and lying might not be as interesting as as the truth.
I just wanted to take a quick break to let you know that after 8 years, I've finally set up a Patreon for the podcast. I wanted to avoid having advertising on Scammapalooza for as long as possible. After all, in a podcast about lies, deceptions, and bullshit, it's not great to be interrupted by ads jammed with, well, lies, deception, and bullshit. And while we may end up with a sponsor a little later on down the track, I really don't want to have those ads that just pop up in the middle, completely killing the vibe. At the same time, putting each episode of Scammapalooza together takes a huge amount of time and resources. So, if you enjoy the podcast, why not click on the link in the show notes and join the Scammapalooza community? Even just the cost of a cup of coffee will make a huge difference and help keep the lights on. Now, back to the podcast. It's almost as if bullshit doesn't just require a lack of respect for the truth, but it also requires some sort of ulterior motive that the bullshitter sees as more important than the truth, whether it's avoidance or persuasion or any of those types of things. That seems to be something that is really vital to the bullshit, that what they're trying to get away with is more important than the truth from their perspective.
Yeah, it's who they are and their agenda. It's, I would say, persuasive and evasive bullshitting is largely Machiavellian in nature. You have an agenda. But it's also important to know that people bullshit without knowing they're doing it, you know, because they're actually, you know, they don't know, like, because they're not supported, they're not coached, they're not trained, they're stressed out, people are just doing their best, you know, in terms of doing things. And so there's this unknowingly bullshitting, I shouldn't have really answered that question with, you know, with the confidence levels that I have, because I should have said I don't know, but I work in an environment where I will look, you know, inadequate if I say I don't know, and maybe even suffer because I say I don't know. And so, you know, so I just made stuff up.
Just because silence is such a horrible thing to deal with. Yeah. People talk about corporate bullshit in a general sense, I find that jargon and lingo seems to be something that comes up a lot, that there is a lot of terminology and phraseology that isn't actually useful, and there might be simpler ways of saying whatever that's going to be saying, and that is, it seems to be a pet peeve for a lot of people. And I noticed you mentioned it in your 2020 paper. You mentioned that as a particular type of bullshit. It does seem to be quite persuasive in organizations, in particular in business. Why is that? Why is there so much of that jargon in those settings?
So that paper is called Confronting Indifference Towards Truth, and it's about dealing with workplace bullshit. And it talks about comprehending that there's a difference between bullshit and lying. That's important. Then recognizing how to spot it when it flows. And it argues that, you know, one way to spot it is that it's going to be articulate, and it's going to be appealing, and it's going to be technically sort of sophisticated. And that technically sophisticated often means it's riddled with acronyms and jargon in terms of going forward. I'm sure you almost certainly know that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about chatbots, and in particular ChatGPT being, you know, very efficient machine producers of bullshit, because they don't know what the truth is unless they've been trained in a specific data set around a particular topic, like a language, you know, some sort of dictionary or term. But when you ask them to, you know, write an essay or to write poetry or to write music, you know, it's particularly, you know, the poetry and the essay is fine because these are often things that don't require facts and evidence. But if you ask them to write an essay or to write a positional piece, what you'll find is people are amazed by the magic of ChatGPT, largely in terms of how articulate it is and how convincing it is. And it may or may not use a lot of acronyms, but it uses a lot of jargon and a lot of technical terms to make it look like it is right in terms of doing things. And so, you know, but it doesn't know whether it is right or not. And when people question and they examine it, you know, they find that it's very sort of articulate nonsense. And I think in the field of AI, this is called AI hallucination. You know, it's like it's hallucinating that it's right. And so going back to the workplace, you know, it's good bullshitters will be people who say stuff which is appealing to the person consuming it, and it will be appealing in maybe that it suits their agenda as well, yeah, the consumer's agenda, but it also comes across as technically robust. And again, there's work this is called the Einstein effect. You know, if you look at how important the person is producing bullshit, it's like an endorsement of what they're saying must be true. And because they're a professor, they're a scientist, they're a Nobel Prize winner, in terms of going forward. And so jargon, acronyms, it's giving it that support.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that what they're saying, if somebody uses this type of jargon a lot, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are bullshitting though. Wanting to be a part of the in-group, just because I say I want to put things on the back burner or circle back around or talk about headwinds and bandwidth, can't that just be the lingo of my people?
It can be. And I agree with you. It's not, a definitive tick, but it's like a warning sign. I think it's an indicator. It's just an indicator that, what was just said to me and why was it phrased that word? Why was it given such embellishment? The people who study bullshit, these are the questions that we want to actually get answers to provide empirical evidence about. Is it truly an indicator, and does it actually have more acronyms and jargon in it? And at the moment, these are largely untested, but you've had Gore Pennicook on the show, and so when you look at his pseudo bullshit, in these randomly produced convincing statements, that sort of works, that doesn't confirm what we're discussing, but it's the foundation for the argument that we think that wording and that use is central to bullshit.
So it's more of a red flag than necessarily evidence of bullshit. The jargon isn't the problem. It just gives the bullshit less places to hide. I think for me, my ambivalence about jargon and its role in bullshit is that I've never worked in a corporate setting, and I spent a long time hating that type of language. And my wife got a government job and started using that type of language. And I realized that my problem wasn't actually with the language. It was just I didn't like the type of people who used that language. It was the language itself wasn't the issue. It's actually I just don't like the sort of person who talks about bandwidth, having bandwidth to do things. And I sort of ask people, like, why don't you like bullshit? And it's like, this type of jargon and lingo. And the reason why, it's obviously just anecdotal, but a lot of people, it really just comes down to, I hate having to go to these meetings and talk like this and use this language. And it's because they don't want to identify themselves as being a part of a group that uses that lingo.
And that's why, sometimes if you want to fit in, people argue that it's a social practice within not just organizations, but as you were saying earlier, teenagers or other, groups and communities, in society, you use this language to fit in, regardless of whether it has any, veracity or any value.
Let's look at solutions, because one of the things I love about your work is that you're not just keen to identify it and explain it, but you're also eager to provide organizations with solutions to solving the problems created by bullshit and lessening its effect in the workplace. I remember reading David Graeber's Bullshit Jobs and being very depressed the whole way through the book, but knowing that the last chapter was the solution, or talking about solutions. And when we got to the final chapter, the solution was, of course, basic universal income, which I think is pretty a massive societal change is the only way that we're going to solve this problem, was a pretty depressing way to finish the book. You, however, have come up with the CRAP, C-R-A-P, CRAP framework as a possible way for organizations to deal with bullshit. And it's very practical and very simple and very straightforward for organizations to understand it and implement it. How did you put that together?
Put it together with a number of colleagues where, at the time, we psychologists, well-grounded in terms of doing it, we're management professors and in areas of marketing, organizational behavior, and innovation. And we started off with that we wanted to sort of tell managers. It was a practitioner paper. It was a journal paper, but it was a practitioner paper where we wanted to tell managers, you should know that there is a difference between bullshit and lying. Here are some of the things you consider. And so, you know, our starting point was Frankfurt. Looked at research on this and put together, you know, a systematic review of the findings, you know, including people whose work you've talked to about on podcasts. And that's how it came about. And, you know, the C stands for comprehend, you know, so, which is basically saying you understand that there is a difference in bullshit and lying, you know, and understand, you know, that bullshit's a statement's not grounded in truth and they have an agenda. And what is the agenda? And that the agenda has some form of task of being appealing and beneficial and confirming. And then we sort of give some tips to sort of recognize when you will be hearing it or reading it, or, you know, exposed to it, saying, you know, yes, it will be riddled with acronym and jargons, but it will be quite well put together, but also at the same time be abstract and lack sources and lack logic, and also be very cognizant that sometimes people are unknowingly bullshit. It's not necessarily this deliberate component. And then the A in the framework, the crap framework, is understanding how people react to it, and that some people, you know, will want to escape. And you were talking about yourself, you know, like, you know, you've never worked in a corporation before, and you know, if you were suddenly plunged into an environment which was flowing with it, you know, you probably wouldn't want to stay very long, and you would want to escape, assuming, you know, your circumstances and your opportunities allowed you to escape. In some cases, you know, you can voice, and this comes from Hirschman's work. Hirschman is a scholar who looked at how people react to sort of unpleasant places, and he says you either escape, if you're lucky you can voice. Many people are loyal to it, to the issues, and some people just disengage and put their head down, or what he calls neglect. And so, you know, exiting is, you know, you don't stay there, you try to move away, you try to get away if you can. If you work in a place, if your personal standing, if the organizational culture allows you to confront the bullshit and ask, you know, ask for evidence, ask for logic, ask for, you know, an explanation. Can you actually do that? But many will be loyal to the bullshit because of the hierarchy, because of, you know, being politically savvy, and they think that that's what they need to survive, or because the agenda which the bullshit is serving actually suits them. And then I think many would also would disengage. They just keep their head down, they hold their nose, and, you know, and they try to get on. And I would imagine loyalty and neglect are the two largest populations. And I say that, you know, as without certainty, that's like a hunch. You know, I think loyalty and neglect would be the two largest population, and exit and voice would be the two smallest population of people in an organization when they experience it. The last one is about preventing it, and sort of tips and advice on how to change your organization. We said that meetings are probably a big source, you know, so, you know, bullshit is a form of communication. And so, you know, we communicate in emails, we communicate one-on-one, but we do a lot of communication. And so when you're designing meetings and running meetings, who's at the meeting, you know, and why have you got people at the meeting? To what extent do you have the right experts at the meeting, or you've invited everybody because you want to be open and you want to be inclusive and you want everybody to have an opinion? And, you know, and on the one hand, there are positives to that, but on the other hand, you know, what do you do with those opinions if those people are not experts, or how do you actually, you know, take together the information? To what extent do you encourage critical thinking within your organization? What is critical thinking? Do you know what it is? And do you know how to, you know, ask why, and go through this in terms of making decisions? And we also, offer, in a follow-on paper, a survey tool that you can use to measure bullshit in your organization. And, you know, you run it within your organization. We do have organizations who have used it, and they use it in conjunction with their other HR surveys to see if, you know, the level of bullshit is higher in marketing than it is in engineering, or is the level of bullshit higher in one region than another region? And how do these levels of bullshit within a organizational unit link to other outcomes such as attrition rates or morale levels or incidences which are actually happening within the organization?
It seems likely to me that an organization that is riddled with bullshit isn't as likely to take up the crap framework to do surveys like this than one that isn't. And often, I mean, if we kind of, you know, believe Graeber with his ideas of bullshit jobs, that often the people who are in a position to make those changes, the kind of people at a management level, are probably the types of people whose jobs actually depend on the bullshit. So have you found the types of organizations taking it up are often not as bullshitty as those that don't?
That's a very good question. We've been involved with two organizations, large organizations, like one of them, 200,000 employees, and drawing the conversations around why they're interested in doing this, because they've had a new leader who values authenticity and veracity and integrity, and maybe is a bit concerned about the levels of bullshit flying through the organization. So I don't know whether the organizations per se are riddled with or high, I just don't know that. But I do know that you're right in that, you know, that there's a leader who's come into the organization, and they have an appetite to explore and see, because they value it personally in terms of going forward. And so who knows, they may be going into an organization which, you know, they, in their personal experience, thinks it is riddled with it, and they want to actually reduce it. But who knows? You know, even though they think that they are authentic leaders, they may be prolific bullshitters themselves. You know, it's hard. That's a very good question. But all I can do is tell you that the circumstances behind the organisations who have asked us to use this as part of their HR scales, and the leaders are leaders who are very concerned with having the right levels of authenticity within
going
the organisation.
Going, I guess, to the other end of the scale. If you do have someone who is an individual within an organization, and you know, bullshit is a large part of the culture, aside, you mentioned obviously leaving, quitting and getting another job. Are there other things they can do individually to, at the very least, reduce the negative effects of bullshit on their day-to-day work life?
Unfortunately, there is, and unfortunately it's really head down and disengage. Mm-hmm. You know, it's disconnect. You know, it's careless. You know, in terms of doing things, you care less about it, and you're less willing to actually take a stance. And so it's this sort of self-protection. And to some extent, that reinforces, you know, the hierarchical levels, the hierarchical structures, and allows things to flow. And you just wait till there's maybe a big disaster that happens in terms of, you know, not being able to question. But yes, but that's what it is. You just keep your head down and survive. And that's one of the actions in our CRAP framework, which says, you know, that this is, and I said that it's only a hunch, but I would say it's probably one of the largest. That with being loyal to bullshit, and the other one disengaging. These are the two biggest ones. You know,
there's
I would say
a phrase that I've heard used, which is to become a grey rock, which is a way of dealing with difficult people. It's a description of just being a grey rock. You're not being assertive, but you're not being submissive. You're just simply there and existing and doing whatever is required. Sounds like a lot of like what you're talking about.
I think I'll be using that, and I will cite you because that's as the inspiration, if not the source. But because I think it is good. You become sort of invisible, you know, to, you don't want to stand out. You don't want to, because you don't want to be you tried being a constructive dissenter. You tried, you know, tried being a terrorist within your own organization, you know, but, it takes up a lot of time. You know, for whatever reason, you don't want to leave, can't leave. So for your own personal, you know, protection and, you know, and well-being, you defer to being a grey rock.
I think maybe that's why there's a lot of affection for the movie Office Space, because the main character, I don't know if he becomes a grey rock, but he does just, he stops engaging with the bullshit structures of his work. Of course, I think in the movie, the downside is he ends up getting promoted and giving more responsibilities.
Well, that's an interesting point you say about getting promoted. Again, we don't know, you know, what's interesting would be to track CEOs, leaders, look at their speeches. We live in this increasingly digitized world where we can look at their speeches, maybe try to assess at the time when the speech was delivered, the language, everything else, give it a bullshit rating. We could then equate it to sort of reality, you know, post-speech in terms of doing things. And we could give a leader over a period of 10, 15 years, you know, bullshit rating, and then equate that with their, their personal rise to the ranks and personal success, and see, you know, does it make people rise faster? But then maybe, you know, you have a big event when you suddenly, you know, you lose your job, and do non-bullshitters run rise slower in terms of doing things? We don't know this, but this is what we could do. You know, one project we're working on at the moment is myself and a finance colleague, or an accounting, financial accounting colleague, and information systems colleague, is that CEOs of companies, when they updates to investors, these are recorded and transcribed, and they have two components. One is they do a presentation, so it's an uninterrupted 10-15 minute presentation. Then they have investors asking them questions, and the transcripts are completely available. And so there are content management tools available already which deal with levels of authenticity in conversations, and we want to build on these and build a, what we call like a bullshit dictionary, to look at the words, the language, the tones, the intonation, and maybe even to do verification checks of statements. And we want to see whether, like, you know, if you listen to a presentation and if it's riddled with bullshit, does that mean that the Q&A session afterwards goes smooth, or is it really contentious where people are questioning in terms of doing things? And also, you look at long-term company performance afterwards in terms of it. And so, what you have to appreciate is that, you know, while this phenomena of bullshit has probably been around forever, you know, it's only really taken off because of Harry Frankfurt's book, because of leadership issues around the world to do, you know, with running country, dealing with COVID, Brexit, you know, anything else in terms of, like, you know, into big issues like this. ChatGPT has raised it quite significantly. Misinformation, disinformation in terms of social media, these have all given rise to a much greater research effort into, because I think Frankfurt's book came out in 2007 or 2009, and, you know, this is a fairly new research area, and so it's, we're not talking with decades and decades of research, and it's taking off, and it's taking a while to take off, but these are the sort of questions which myself and others are hoping to work on.